This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Because Shlomo HaMelech tells us that Torah, in order to get a type of code that works one day. In order to get an understanding of Torah, one has to put the same degree into learning as one puts into mining. So it's important to have an appreciation of what effort goes into mining, so as to know what kind of effort has to go into learning. For that reason, I would recommend that everybody take the opportunity sometime soon of going down a gold mine. And one tends to think of the real expertise of the mining and the major area of effort as being the bringing up of the coal or the gold or the minerals, whatever it is, from underground. And in truth, that's not so. While sure, that's a very important part of it, and that's the bulk of it, but that's not where the skill of mining lies. The skill of mining lies in the purification process. Because what do you dig out of the ground? You dig sand and stones out of the ground. And for every ton of sand and stones, you've got about 3 or 4 grams of gold, if you're lucky. And the art is to be able to remove that 3 or 4 grams of gold out of the stone and make sure that there are no impurities left in the gold with which you're left. Is that right, Stephen? You're the mining guy.
In underground.
Oh, you go to the wrong part of the mine. Underground is more dramatic, but the chokhmah is all on top of the ground. And I think that in Torah too, the challenge of a Torah life is not in the bulk of the Torah. Sure, one has to do mitzvahs and one mustn't do averas. Obviously, that's part of Torah. Sure, there's an awful lot that we have to do and an awful lot that we're not allowed to do. But that's not where the challenge of living a Torah life comes. The challenge of living a Torah life is in the refinement process. In the slow process, mitzvahs, lo nitznu mitzvahs ela letzarech bo'enes habriyos. The mitzvahs were given for one reason only, and that's to purify people. And it's that challenge of purification of ourselves that we have to experience and that we have to improve on. That's where the skill of living a Torah life lies. There's no skill in putting on tefillin. There's no skill in eating kosher and not eating treif. It's a little bit of self-discipline, that's all. It's just the very basis of a normal human life. There's no real skill. You don't have to be particularly talented. But in purification, which is the real purpose of what the Torah is all about, in the purification, taking this lump, which is us, the ton of material, and purifying it and purifying it and purifying it until we're left maybe with very little, but pure. That's what the art of Torah is. I want to show you an interesting medrash. There's this one guy flying around all the hell out of them. In the medrash, in this week's Sedra, that there are three things which Moshe did on his own accord, and the Ribbono Shel Olam agreed with it. I'm not going to do the first two, but the third one is the following. Dorash bechukas haPesach. He learned out from the principle of the Korban Pesach, which appears in our Sedra this week. Keshe osu Yisrael es haEgel, when the Jews made the golden calf and he brought the tablets of stone down and he found them dancing around the golden calf. Omar, he said, Uma ima Pesach shehayon l'sho'o b'mitzrayim, the Korban Pesach, which only took a few minutes or a few hours in Eretz Mitzrayim. Omar li, the Ribbono Shel Olam says to me, Zois chukas haPesach kol ben nechar, etc. This is the law of the Pesach. An idol worshipper cannot eat from it. Yisrael she'ovdu avodah zorah yecholin hayin lekabel es haTorah. Is it possible that the Jews who've served idolatry around the golden calf can receive the whole Torah? The one mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, of the sacrifice for Pesach, they're not allowed to do after they've served idolatry. How can I go and give them the whole Torah now? Immediately Moshe took the tablets of stone and he smashed them at the foot of the mountain. That was his heter for doing it. That's how he worked out that that was the correct thing to do. It wasn't just a spontaneous anger. He worked it out halachically that he had no right to give the Torah to people who were serving idolatry. The first question I have is on the Midrash itself, and that is, there are many things an idol worship is allowed to do. Thanks. If a person served idolatry, he's still allowed to keep Shabbos if he wants. If a person served idolatry, he's still allowed to keep kashrus if he wants. If a person served idolatry, he's still allowed to put on tefillin if he wants. So why does Moshe Rabbeinu learn out from the one din which is an exception, rather than from all the other din which seem to be the rule? The rule is that even if you've served idolatry, you can still do the mitzvahs.
There's one mitzvah which you can't do, the Korban Pesach. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, you see, they're not allowed to bring the Korban Pesach, so how can I give them the Torah? But they're allowed to do everything else on the Torah. So that's the first question on the Midrash itself.
Second question is, one of the other restrictions placed on the eating of the Korban Pesach is the following. V'chi yogur itcho geir, and if a potential convert is staying with you, v'oso Pesach la'Hashem, and he wants to make a Pesach for the Ribbono Shelolam, he wants to bring a Korban Pesach, himoil loy kol zocho, you shall circumcise all their males, v'az yikrav la'asoyso, and then he can come forward to do the Korban Pesach, to bring the sacrifice, v'hoyo ke'ezrach ha'oritz, and he'll be like a citizen of the land, v'chol orel lo yoichal boy, and anybody uncircumcised may not eat from the Korban Pesach. Says Rashi, based on the Gemara, v'chol orel lo yoichal boy, we've already been told that non-Jews can't eat it, and that he has to be circumcised before he can eat it. What does it mean, v'chol orel, all of a sudden that a non-circumcised person can't eat it? We've already learned that. Says Rashi, l'havi es shemesu echov machmas milo she'eno mumel orlois. Says Rashi, this comes to include even a person whose brothers have died as a result of a bris.
So when he was born, the din was that if two brothers, I think it's two, possibly three, have died because of a bris milah, then the din is that the third one doesn't have to have a bris milah. He doesn't have to have a bris. And he's one of these people that we're talking about. In other words, there's no obligation on him to have a bris. Nevertheless, he's not allowed to eat from the Korban Pesach. Why not? He's done nothing wrong. I can understand that a goy can't eat from the Korban Pesach. I can understand that a person who served idolatry can't eat from the Korban Pesach. I can understand that a person who's uncircumcised can't eat from the Korban Pesach. But why a person is not obligated to be circumcised? He's a Jew and he has no chiyuv for milah. He doesn't have to have a bris. He's done nothing wrong. He's fully entitled to be as he is. Yet he's not allowed to eat from the Korban Pesach. Why? Those are the two questions we've got to answer. We tend to think that an Aveiro is something that we do and then it's passed. Thanks. And then it's over. It's a tick against on our copybook and or an X on our copybook, and we have to do tshuva to get the X undone, and then we're back to where we started and there's no problem. That's not so. An Aveiro, even the tiniest little Aveiro, those Aveiros that we're doing all the time, every one is another straw on the camel's back. It's another contributor to a distancing between ourselves and the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's not just an action which was done and hasn't affected us. We've done something wrong, so the thing that we've done has been affected, but we're not affected by our actions. No, we're affected as well.
And in fact, David HaMelech says in chapter Nun Aleph, which is a beautiful chapter of Tehillim, where he prays for forgiveness for his Aveiro, with Bathsheba, which the Gemara says that if anybody says that David HaMelech committed an Aveiro with Bathsheba, he's mistaken. It wasn't an Aveiro. Yet David HaMelech himself realizes that there was a slight, on his level, there was a slight touch of incorrectness, and for that he does tshuva. And the Medrash says the following. Mikan, from here we learn, Shekol ha'over Aveiro ki'ilu nitma benefesh meis. Anybody who does an Aveiro, any Aveiro, it's as if he's been exposed to Tumas Meis. There are different kinds of Tuma, of spiritual impurity. One of them is the type of spiritual impurity resulting from contact with a dead body. And the Medrash says, we learn from here, that any Aveiro committed leaves a human being in the same category or as if he's been exposed to Tumas Hameis. As David HaMelech says, Techat Eini Be'ezov v'ataher, give me the treatment with the ezov, and I shall become tahor, I shall become pure. Ask the Medrash, v'chi nitma David? Why does David ask for purification? Did he become tome? We don't know anywhere where he became tome. Elo ha'ovin shehu chalal ha'nefesh. But it's the ovin, it's the sin, which is the dead body of the soul. The Medrash goes on a little bit. The Medrash says again that anybody who commits an Aveira, and again even the slightest little Aveiras, because this Aveira of David HaMelech is considered, the Gemara says, if we think we understand what was wrong with it, we're even wrong. It was such a fine Aveira that we can't even understand what was wrong with it. But David HaMelech could understand that there was a hair's breadth of wrong.
And for that hair's breadth of wrong, he regards himself, and the Medrash learns from there for everybody, that it's ke'ilu nitma b'meis, as if you've experienced contact with a dead body. So you might say, so what? You've experienced contact with a dead body, it also doesn't affect you. But it does affect you. Do you realize that you're going to have a Kohen, who's a Kohen in all the senses of the word, and he has a contact with a dead body, and he's not allowed to duchen? Why isn't he allowed to duchen? That closeness that a Kohen has normally got with the Ribbono Shel Olam, which enables him to bless the people, is impaired by his contact with a dead body, and his halachic status changes. He can't do the things he could do before. He's actually deteriorated spiritually, and he needs to revitalize himself, he needs to repurify himself. And until he does so, he's actually degenerated. There's been a decrease of spirituality and of spiritual contact with the Ribbono Shel Olam. It affects us as well. At the moment, the reason we can't, when we go to the Kotel, the reason we can't go beyond the Kotel in Yerushalayim, the reason we can't go out onto the actual place where the Beis HaMikdash used to stand, is because we've had contact with dead bodies. So let's imagine the Mashiach came and the Por HaAdumah was made available and we all cleansed ourselves, and now we could go to the Beis HaMikdash, and on Pesach we'll all go, we'll stand there, and the Mashiach will be there, and the Kohen Gadol will be there, we'll have a wonderful time, and we plan to go again. Shavuos comes between Pesach and Shavuos, and Chas V'Sholom, we've had some kind of contact with a dead body, can't go in. It affects one. It's not something which is just, okay, there's a concept of tumor, some ethereal kind of concept. That concept of tumor, of tumas hames, is sufficiently real to affect your halachic status and impose limitations on you. When you stand at the Kotel and you look and you think, oh, if only I could go in, the reason you can't is because of tumas hames. So we mustn't tend to underestimate the power of that tumas hames. The extent to which we are worse off because we've had contact with tumas hames. Even if we can't understand it, even if we can't feel it, even if we have no intuitive knowledge of it, but the facts are that that is what bars us from going any further. There we stand, looking nostalgically or longingly at the Mokum Beis HaMikdash, and we can't go in. Tumas Hames. And that same kind of Tumas Hames is something we experience every time we commit an Avera. Even a little Avera. Every time we commit an Avera, there's that experience of Tumas Hames. It's a further wrenching away from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's another mechitza, it's another barrier between the Ribbono Shel Olam and us. And us. A little word of Lashon Hara, a little dishonesty, a little eating something without the correct brocha, without a brocha at all, saying Kriya Shema without the correct, incorrectly or at the wrong time. Little things, or what might appear to be little things, but each one of them is Tumas Hamed. Each one of them has the effect on us of imposing barriers similar to that of Tumas Hamed. And here we see the purification. Why is that? Why does an Avera impose a tumor on us? Because what is tumor? Tumor is impurity. Taharo is purity. What is the impurity? Why did I do the Avera? It couldn't have been because of pure spiritual motivation. In other words, if I do an Avera, it is indicative that in my decision-making process, there is a lack of purity. Because if my decision-making process was pure, if it was only my seichel, if it was only my knowledge and my neshama that were involved in taking decisions, then what I would do, I would always do right. The fact that I've done wrong means that in my decision making process, there is an element which is impure. Imagine you have a court case, and your life's at stake. And you're being held for suspected murder or whatever it is, and you're standing in court, and you keep on getting the feeling that the judge is going to decide on the basis of his own personal feelings. And that you're going to make a nice impression with the judge all the time, because it's not going to be a legal decision. Imagine what you feel like. Any respect for him? Do you feel any confidence for him? Do you feel you'll have a close relationship with him, whether you're saved or you're not saved? Nothing. If he saves you, it's not because he believes you weren't guilty. If he commits you, it's not because he believes that you are guilty. It's just an emotional reaction. There's no purity. It's not academic. It's not legal. And if one would go to a doctor for advice, and find that he's giving one advice which is not pure medical advice. He's got some other ideas in his mind. He needs some more patience, or he wants to do some experimentation. It's not pure. And the results aren't pure. The results are wrong. And likewise, when the Ribbono Shel Olam sees us taking decisions based not only on Torah, but on other interests as well, the barrier must exist. That same feeling that you would have with the judge we talked about, is the feeling kebiyochel that the Ribbono Shel Olam has with his people, when his people are not treating him academically, when his people are not treating him professionally, There's a professionalism to living. And that means understanding and knowing the rights and wrongs of life and knowing how to take decisions in life on the basis of those rights and wrongs, and one's decisions should be based on nothing else. That's the professionalism of living, and that's what the Ribbono Shel'olam expects from us. He says, do what you want, you've got bechira, you've got free will. But judge professionally, don't act like children. So if one's committed an aveira, one knows that in one's decision-making process, there are elements other than right and wrong involved. That's what I said at the beginning. That the fun of Torah, that the challenge of Torah, that the difficulty of Torah, is not doing or not doing aveiros. That's relatively easy. The difficulty is to see that an aveiro is an expression of the fact that in your decision-making process there's still things other than right and wrong involved. And that one has to be able to face up to and start the purifying. Once you've got the Torah, once you're committed to Yiddishkeit and you're basically keeping the mitzvahs, you've got the ton of material out of the ground, but it's all stone. You can't sell that. You can't sell it for $800, and you can't even sell it for anything. Nobody will take it from you. It's got 3 grams of gold in it. Get the 3 grams out and then we'll talk. So it is. Committed to Yiddishkeit, very nice. But that's the beginning, not the end. Committed to Yiddishkeit means you've got the material from under the ground to over the ground. You're now ready to start working with it. But what's the work? The first stage of refinement that we're discussing this evening is the refinement or the refining of the decision-making process. That in your decision of what you'll do and what you won't do, there's only one element, right and wrong. That's all you're interested in. But that's what being a Jew means. Unfortunately, in our time, it's not just that where one worries about people who are not Yirei Shemayim, about people who are not frum people, is one going to get a genuine opinion. Today, even with frum people, one very often has that fear. Is one going to get a genuine opinion? The reason? Because it isn't appreciated fully enough that this is where Torah starts, this is not where Torah finishes. That this is what being frum means. Being frum doesn't mean keeping the mitzvahs. Everybody must keep the mitzvahs. That's not being special. That's being Jewish. You keep Shabbos, you keep kashrus, you do all the things that you're supposed to do. That's being Jewish. That's not being frum. That's not being special. Being special is starting to work on the Torah. Starting to refine yourself to the point where there's nothing in your decision-making process other than right and wrong. And that when somebody comes to talk to you or when you're talking to yourself, the answer you'll give yourself or you'll give them is one you believe to be right, and you're not interested in anything else. Might not be convenient, it might not be expedient, and it might not be profitable, but that just doesn't matter in the profession of Torah. This purity and impurity expresses itself also in positive mitzvahs. There's a Gemara, a well-known Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Vav Amud Beis. The Gemara says the following: Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Rav, Kol ma she'oso Avraham lemaloche hashores ba'atzmo. You remember the story. Avraham was old and sick. He had just had his bris milah. It was the third day after his bris milah, and as anybody who's had any contact with people who've had operations will know, the third day after the operation is the most painful. So Avraham Avinu was already an old man, couldn't have been feeling too comfortable, and it was as hot as anything. And he sees these three people walking down the road, and we've discussed before it wasn't Rabbi Kiva Eger and the Vilna Gaon and the Noda B'Yehuda walking down the road. It wasn't even Carter Kosygin and Mrs. Thatcher walking down the road. It was three Arabs, three Africans walking down the road. Avraham Avinu decides to watch how they relate to one another. Are they special people or not? He's not worried about color, and he's not worried about religion or whatever it is. Are they special people or not? If they're special people, I've got time for them. If they're not special people, I don't care who they are. I've got no time for them. Let's see if they're special people. And he watches to see how they relate to one another. Are they showing kovod to one another? And he watches and he finds they are showing kovod to one another. And you remember the story. Avraham Avinu, the king, the man who was held in such esteem, sees these three Arabs up the road, but they're showing respect to one another, and he runs in all his pain and in the midst of the heat, he runs up to meet them, he bows down to them and implores them to come into his home. And there you remember how he treats them and so on. Says Rav Yehuda, in the name of Rav, everything which Avraham did himself, also HaKadosh Baruch Hu Levonov Abba'atzma. Later on, God did the same thing for Avraham's children also himself. And everything which Avraham did by messenger,
Osakodesh Baruch Hu Levona Validei Shaliach. The Ribbono Shel Olam also did by messenger later on. And the Gemara gives examples. The El HaBakor Ratz Avrom. Avrom himself ran to get cattle, to get meat for the visitors. Similarly, Veruach Noso Meis Hashem, Veruach Noso Meis Hashem, and the wind came and brought the quail. The Ribbono Shel Olam himself gave his children meat in the desert. And he takes milk and batter and milk. There's the mon. Avraham Avinu himself prepares the batter and the milk for his guests. Avraham himself feeds the people in the desert with mon. The Ribbono Shel Olam himself feeds the people in the desert with mon. He stands and serves them at the table. No servants. He had plenty of servants, but not for visitors. Visitors I serve myself. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, when you have to get the water out of the rock, I'll be standing there ready with you. And Avraham went with them to send them off. He saw them off out of his home. Hashem walked in front of the Bnei Israel. Hashem himself did. All these were as results of Avraham's action so many hundreds of years earlier. But yukach no miat mayim, when Avraham says, you may take for yourselves some water, that means the one thing Avraham didn't do himself was wash their feet. Everything else he did himself. The one thing he didn't do is physically take their feet and wash their feet. And for that, when it comes to getting water out of the rock, the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you hit the rock. It's not just going to come. I'm not going to do it. You'll have to do it yourself. Take the water yourself. There's the rock. Help yourself. So there's a slight criticism of Avraham here. But let's not get into the criticism or not criticism. What's amazing is the extent to which the taharo here used in the sense of the purity of action affects the relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, not only for yourself but for your family and children and children later on. Because he didn't just invite them into their home but he did it himself. Because he didn't just send somebody to collect the meat but he did it himself. Because he didn't call a waiter but he waited himself. There was a closeness with the Ribbono Shel Olam, there was a taharo, there was a purity which the Ribbono Shel Olam responds with during their period in the desert, and he himself gives them everything that they need. Yukach nami atmayim, it comes to washing their feet, and Avraham says, please, here's the water, help yourselves. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, okay, there's a little bit of a lack of something in that, you should have washed their feet too. Why is that considered a bit of tumor in a sense as well? Why is this also considered something which distances you from the Ribbono Shel Olam? Again, for the same reason. Why don't you go to the very nth degree in any mitzvah? Why do you stop short? We all do it with every mitzvah. We always stop short of the end. Learning a piece of Gemara, when we start getting tired, we can be 1 minute away from really grasping it. All you have to do is close your Gemara before you go to bed and revise it without looking inside the Gemara. And that you'll chap it like you can't imagine. It will make the 2 hours you spend learning really worthwhile. It will give you more than you've had the whole 2 weeks, that 1 minute, but we don't do it. Close the Gemara and get to bed without doing it. It's hard to do it. What is it that stops us doing it? We're tired. There's something in it. Again, if it was just the purity of our neshamas, if it was just our intellect operating without anything else to hold us back, we would go right to the nth degree. We wouldn't leave anything until it was done to the absolute ultimate of our ability. What is it that holds us back? An interested party. The same thing that holds the judge back from giving an honest opinion, or that holds the doctor or the lawyer or whoever it is from giving an honest opinion, if he has a negia, if he has some side interest. What's the side interest? I've got a body that wants to go to bed. I'm lazy. That's all. That's also tumor. That's also a lack of refinement, because the refinement is when you get rid of all this unnecessary burden, all these things that hold you back. Again, your decision making process is not being left unfettered. There's something holding you back. Why don't you go to the end? You know it's important to do the mitzvah. Why don't you do it a little bit better? There's a yetzahara. After all, there are other needs too. Mitzvahs aren't the only thing. That's what it comes out to. Here too, there's a tumor. And as one gives in to this drive, whether it's in the first case of actually doing an aveira, or it's the second case of just not going fast far enough, as one gives in to the drive, you're reinforcing that tumor. You're adding to it a little bit more, a little bit more. Imagine a Rosha walked in. Imagine a Rosha walked in right now and we all stood up. That would reinforce his wickedness. And if a
Rosha tells you to do something. Rosha says, just bring me a cup of tea, please. And you bring the cup of tea for him. That reinforces his rishus. The Rosha tells you, do an Aveira. I know it's not right. But, you know, sometimes one has to be human as well. And one does it. That strengthens the tumor. That strengthens the party that is interested in things other than right and wrong. When you want to take a thing till the nth degree and there's something which holds you back and you've got to go to bed or you've got to go and eat or you've got to go and work, you've got to do this or you've got to do that, there's always a million excuses why you can't take the thing to the end. What is it? You give it in, you give in, you're reinforcing that force which stopped you from doing it in the first place. And when I talk about the need in Torah of refining and purifying, that's what we're talking about. Getting rid of all this rubbish that gets in the way of excelling. Gets in the way of excelling on the first level by making us do things we don't really want to do if we were just operating on right and wrong. And if we're beyond that stage already, or partially beyond that stage, we still have the problem that these extra burdens, or whatever you want to call them, hold us back from going as far as we would really like to go. And one has to rid oneself of those extra burdens. They're not necessary. They get in the way. They're liabilities. They're not desirable. There's a third kind of impurity. And that's an impurity of motivation. Let's say you do the action perfectly. Whether it's your tefillin, or it's lighting your candles, or it's your learning, whatever it is. Let's say you really do it to the best of your ability. You've put everything you've got into that mitzvah. You've been mosa nefesh, you've dedicated, you've put your life at stake for that mitzvah. And a lot. One thing wrong. You did it for Avodah Zarah. That's it. You did it for Christianity, not for Torah. Let's say such a thing, chas v'sholom. So let's give an example. It's not Shabbos, let's say it's chesed. You do a maisa chesed, you do an act of chesed which is unbelievable. It's incredible, the act of chesed that you do. It's your life is in danger, but you do it, and you put everything at the finest mitzvah you've ever done. And anybody looking at that mitzvah could find nothing wrong with it. Somebody says to you afterwards, why? What motivated you to do such a heroic act? And you say, chas v'sholom, so that Yoshka should save me. That means that the act, as good as it looks, is an act of Avodah Zarah. That's what idolatry is. Doing what might be the right thing for the wrong reason. Idolatry is not something one can define in any fixed term. Idolatry is not so. You can't say this is an act of idolatry and this isn't. Is bowing down an act of idolatry? No, it depends who you bow to. If you bow to the Ribbono Shel Olam, it's not an act of idolatry. If you bow to an idol, it is. Is bringing a sacrifice idolatry? No. If you bring it in the Beis Hamikdash, it's a mitzvah. If you bring it to idolatry, it is idolatry. It's Avodah Zarah. So we define idolatry not by actions, but by motivation. In honor of who are you doing it? Why are you doing it? And we've mentioned before that Avodah Zarah is not something which applied only in generations gone by. Avodah Zarah is something which we live with very much every day of our lives. Let me give you an example. One does a mitzvah, but one does the mitzvah not to shame the mitzvah, not for the sake of the mitzvah, not for the sake of idolatry either, but one does it in order that you should look a little bit frumer. People should get an impression that after all you're a frum person. That's what it is. Or let's say you do it because you want to earn money that way. You decide to go to yeshiva not to learn the Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah, but you want to be a rabbi as a profession. If it's the second one, where you want reward, okay. That the Mesillas Yeshorim says is a case of rather do it shelo lishma than not at all, rather do it for the wrong reasons than not at all. At least it has educational value, and it's not the end of the world. It's not counted as a mitzvah to the same extent, but it's not the end of the world. But if you do it to fool people, if you do it to create an impression which is untrue, even if you don't know that it's untrue, but the Ribbono Shel Olam knows it's untrue, that is idolatry. That means that you're doing it. Why? Because you want someone to think that you're something that you aren't. So why are you doing the mitzvah? Who's your God? The person you're trying to impress. And Rabbeinu Bechaya in the Chovas Halvavos classes that hypocrisy, as he calls it, as worse than Avodah Zarah. And it's worse than Avodah Zarah for four reasons which we'll come to. But at the moment, let's just satisfy ourselves with it saying it's Avodah Zarah. It's as bad as Avodah Zarah. to do a mitzvah in order to impress somebody is avodah zarah. It's better not to do it at all, because you're doing it not for the Ribbono Shel Olam. You're doing it for the person, or for the society, or for the cult, as we talked a few weeks ago. It makes no difference. You want to belong. You're doing it because you want to belong. Who's your God? The people to whom you want to belong, not the Ribbono Shel Olam. A mitzvah is only when you're doing it for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Or Shelo Nishmo means that you want some kind of reward out of it. Okay, that's bad, but it's not the end of the world. But to impress somebody, that means he's your God, not the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Rabbeinu Bechaya says it's worse than avodah zarah, it's worse than idolatry. The first reason he gives is a technical halachic reason. The second reason is he says an idolater serves the trees, or he serves the sun and the moon. At least the sun and the moon have done nothing wrong to the Ribbono Shel Olam. At least the trees have done nothing wrong to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But who are you serving? An ordinary human being who probably isn't the biggest tzaddik around. Because if he was the biggest tzaddik around, you wouldn't have to impress him. So that's who your God is. Your society. Down to the sun and the moon, then bow down to a society, or to individuals that you're trying to impress, or whom you're trying to feel a part of. Second reason, he says, an idolater at least only has one God. It's not the one God, but you'll find idolaters who worship the sun, but it's only the sun. And idolaters who worship the moon, but it's only the moon. Idolaters who worship Buddha, but it's only Buddha. But a person who is of weak character, because that's the guy we're talking about after all, a person who doesn't have the confidence to find out what's right and wrong and do it no matter what his society says, the person who's constantly trying to impress the group in which he moves, or to impress particular individuals, there's no end to the number of idols he worships. Wherever he'll find himself in a situation that he wants to impress somebody, it's another idol. So it's avodah zarah over and over and over again with different idols. And thirdly, says the Rabbeinu Bechaya, and perhaps this is the most important reason of all, an idolater everybody knows. A Buddhist, a Hindu. We all know them. They're no threat to us. We're not worried that they're going to influence us. Well, that's their religion and this is ours and there's no problem. But this guy, the guy who's out to impress and is prepared to do mitzvahs to impress, that fellow is dangerous because people don't know him. They don't know he's an idolater. He doesn't look like an idolater. He keeps Shabbos. He keeps kashrus. He keeps taras hamishpocha. He is careful about Lashon Hora. He doesn't talk Lashon Hora. He walks with the correct kind of stoop so that he should not appear arrogant. He davens with a minyan every day. He puts on his tefillin. He's a difficult guy to identify, this idol worshipper. But he's worse than an oved avodah zarah. He's worse than an idol worshipper, and one has to be able to identify him, says Rabbeinu Bechaya. If that's the case with mitzvahs, if Rabbeinu Bechaya views a person who does mitzvahs for the wrong reason so severely, imagine how he views people who do things which aren't even mitzvahs. Justam meshugasim, or chumras, or whatever it is, for the sake of impressing. That's even worse. It's the same thing, it's a need to do in order to find favor in the eyes of someone other than God. And that can never be a motivation for anything we do. Let's look at the Chumash now. And see what it says. The first thing it says, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe ve'Aaron, and God says to Moshe and Aaron, Zois chukas ha-posach, this is the law of the Pesach. Kol ben necha lo yoichal bo. Any ben necha, any stranger lo yoichal bo, may not eat from it. What does necha mean? Nochri appears, although not in the noun form, is in fact in Bereshis, when the brothers meet Yosef for the first time back in Egypt. And it says, as they walk into the marketplace to buy their corn, Vayar Yosef es Echov Vayakirem, and Yosef saw his brothers and recognized them. Vayisnaker alehem, and he was mitnaker, we'll decide in a moment what that means, to them. Vayedaber itom koshos, and he talked harshly to them, etc.
And then it says later, and they didn't recognize him. It says Rashi, Vayitna kera lehim, Nase lohem kenochri, he appeared to them as a stranger, bidvorim ladaber kashris,
in that he talked harshly. So what does the word Vayitna kera mean? He's a brother after all. By talking harshly, not as a brother would talk, he disguised himself. They thought that he appeared as a stranger. It didn't enter their mind that he was a brother. Vayitna kera therefore means he disguised himself. So what does a ben neichar mean now? To anybody in disguise may not eat from the korban pesach. That becomes difficult to understand. What does it mean? If you have a fancy dress party, you can't have the korban pesach? No, let's see exactly what it means. Vayitna ker and the ben neichar. What is an oved avodah zarah? Like along the lines that we've just described him. A man who does holy actions for the wrong reasons, for the wrong gods. Right, that's who an Oved Avodah Zarah is. So he comes over as a holy person. Let's talk about our Jewish Oved Avodah Zarah, because that's the person who the Pasuk is talking about, not about a Buddhist. We're talking about a frum Jew here who wants to eat a Korban Pesach. He's a person who keeps the mitzvahs possibly, but keeps them for the wrong reason. He does it for the sake of some other god. Right? Whether it's society, or it's his rabbi, or his wife, or his children, or his cousins, or his friends, it makes no difference. Or Yoshkele Chas V'Sholem, or Buddha, or whatever it is. Some other god is doing the mitzvahs, but not for the Ribbono Shel Olam. So he's a man in disguise. That's what Rabbeinu Bechaya said. He's the guy you've got to be careful of, more than an Oved Avodah Zarah in the normal sense. Because normal idolaters are not in disguise. But the hypocrite is an Oved Avodah Zarah who's in disguise. And that's the essence of the Jewish idolater, of the Orthodox Jewish idolater, of the practicing Jewish idolater. That's his problem. He's in disguise. You can't recognize him. He looks frum. Vayitna ker Yosef. Yosef disguised himself, and we're told in Shemot, v'chol ben nechar lo yochel Yosef, a man who comes over in disguise, that means toichoy einoy kebaroy. His inside is not like his outside. What he appears to you is not what he is. Who he appears to you is not what he is. When you come across such a man, lo yochal boy, he can't eat the korban pesach. And that's why the Rambam paskens, in fact, in Perek Tes, unlike Rashi, uven nechar ha'omur b'toira, and this word ben nechar, which is used in the Torah, ze ha'oved el nechar. This is a man who worships a strange god. Now, the Rambam, whenever he talks about idolatry, talks about Avodah Zarah or Oved Kechavim. So much so that even when he doesn't mean idolatry, he just means a non-Jew, he talks about Oved Kechavim. Here he talks about a person who's Oved El Necha, serves a strange god. It might not be Avodah Zarah in the normal sense of the word, might not be serving stars in the literal sense of the word, but it's a person who serves Kel Necha. It's a person who serves gods in disguise. The god you think he's serving is not the god he's really serving. So why can't he eat the Korban Pesach? He can keep Shabbos, he can keep Kashrus, he can put on tefillin. Why do we understand why we hate the hypocrite? Understand why we call him worse than an Oved Avodah Zarah? I understand why we hate an idol worshipper. But why can the idol worshipper not bring a Korban Pesach? The Gemara in Psochim says that the Korban Pesach loy bo mitchilosoy elo la'achila. Its whole purpose, its original raison d'etre, is for eating. Unlike other korbanos. Other korbanos have all other sorts of reasons as to why they were created and why they were formulated. And some of them you may eat, parts of them, and others you may not eat, etc. In other words, eating is simply a part of the general avoida, of the general service with the other sacrifices. But not with the Korban Pesach. With the Korban Pesach, the eating is the essence of it. Now what is eating? Eating is very simply the integration into the body of nourishment that it needs from its surroundings. How does it do it? Also very simple. It takes the same way as you mine gold. It takes the ton of material and it discards the rubbish and it breaks down the good stuff. And it breaks it and breaks it and breaks it until it gets down to its essential elements. And that's what it absorbs. And again, as it goes through the breakdown process, it discards anything which isn't taking it closer to the essential element. As one will purify any element, any metal or any mineral. Purify to get down to the essential elements which you'll separate, and that's what you're left with. That's what you want. That's achilu. Achilu is the body's instinctive method of purification. It takes something from outside which is impure, a mixture of all sorts of vitamins and proteins and carbohydrates and rubbish and the whole lot, and it splits it up, not just into those categories, but into much more scientific categories and much more basic categories. And it's that final thing which it's able to consume, which it's able to integrate and to absorb, and it discards the rest. That's the purification. The concept of the Korban Pesach, which we'll clarify in one moment a little bit more clearly, is an exercise in achilah. It's the only time in eating. It's the only time in the Torah that eating is made a service of. Yeah, there are mitzvahs of eating, there are mitzvahs that involve eating. But a mitzvah where the whole mitzvah is just the eating, where everything else was designed for the eating. Unlike Shabbos, where one of the things you've got to do on Shabbos is eat. And one of the things you've got to do on Yom Tov is eat. And one of the things you've got to do at the Bris Milah is eat. That's not the case with the Korban Pesach. With the Korban Pesach, the reason you have to bring a Korban Pesach is in order that you can eat it. So it's a spiritual exercise in achilo, in eating. What does achilo mean? What does eating mean? Purification. It teaches us. If we would study what eating is, it teaches us how to absorb from our environment, how to integrate from our environment, and how to be selective from our environment. The Oved Avodah Zarah, what's he? He's exactly opposite to that. He's the guy who has the impurity. He's the guy who's unable to escape in his basic motivation for doing anything. Why does he do anything? Why does he do what he does? Not one god, two gods, or three gods, or 10 gods, or 20 gods. He hasn't even found purity in his god. He hasn't even discovered one god. And his motivation for every one of his actions is not a process of purification, as one should be involved in Torah. It's a process of more things in and more things and a mixture and a mixture and a mixture and more and more and more and just out to impress more and more people. And that's against the whole concept of the Korban Pesach, which is one of getting down to basics. Don't forget, the Korban Pesach is cooked very simplistically. It's put on a spit and it's roasted. Nothing added to it. That's it. It's treated, it's eaten very basically. Remember also our whole theory about Pesach and the matzahs. The difference between matzah and bread being that matzah is bread without the hot air. It's bread without the extra, without the unnecessary, without the burden. And it's that which holds you down all the time. It's things other than the essence that prevent us from getting to the essence. It's interests other than the main interests that prevent us being honest. It's motivations other than the Ritzon Hashem, other than the will of God, which makes us do things other than the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And what we have to do is constantly eliminate these other things so that ultimately we land up pure and straightforward and simple. So Moshe's comparison is very good. He says, yes, sure, an Oved Avodah Zarah is allowed to do all sorts of other mitzvahs in the Torah. And he's allowed to keep kashrus, and he's allowed to keep Shabbos, and he's allowed to keep everything. But he's not allowed to eat the Korban Pesach. Why not? Because the Korban Pesach is integration by purification. That's what it is. What is Torah? Torah is the same. You'll remember the Medrash in Bereishis when Yaakov says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, if you'll be very kind to me and you'll give me lechem, lechol, food to eat, to veged, lilbush, and clothes to wear, and I'll give you a tenth of everything I own. And the Medrash says, is that all that Yaakov could ask for? He doesn't ask for siyata dishmaya and his learning. He doesn't ask that he should find a good wife. All he asks for is a bit of food and clothes. He wants material things. There's the Medrash, that's not what he means. Ein lechem ela Torah. Lechem is Torah. When he talks about food to eat, he means spiritual food to eat. One sees already the way that we regard Torah to the neshama as food to the body. Torah does to the spirit what food does to the body, but contrarywise too. The soul does to Torah what the body does to food. What does that mean? We have to integrate Torah. We have to absorb it. Unfortunately, our systems of learning, current systems of learning, are systems which equate to a human being who would discard everything he eats. That's it. In one and out the other, and that's it. Constantly moving in. He doesn't remember anything. It doesn't stay with him. It doesn't change him. He doesn't grow with it. It doesn't make him healthier. It leaves him untouched. In is just a machine. In and out, and in and out, and in and out. And all he's watching is turnover. how many pages is turned over. That's all that's important. But as far as the integration is concerned, how much is part of him, how much is absorbed, that is not important. That's not there. That's not how it works. Torah is like food. Rather have a little bit of food if you're sick. If you're not strong yet, how do you start making a person strong? Slowly, you give him a little bit of food, let him integrate it, let the body get used to it, you give him a little bit more, you vary the diet according to what he needs and feed him a little bit more still until he's able to eat more and more. You make sure that he's never eating more than he needs, because then he gets fat and disgusting. And a person who's learning Torah faster than he can integrate it, I don't know about getting fat, but he gets disgusting. He starts doing things that are disgusting. He starts behaving in a disgusting way. He starts becoming arrogant. He starts becoming holier than thou. And he has no idea at all of what the Torah is really demanding from him. It's just going too quickly. It's the same as eating too much. It's obesity. Slowly absorb it. Integrate it. Understand it. Feel it. Live it. Let it affect you. Then a little bit further. Learn something new. Learn something more. The same process. Absorb it. Understand it. Integrate it. That's how it has to be. And how do we do it? By the same process. You can't absorb in the same way as the body can't absorb something impure. It has to be broken down to its basic elements. So the neshama and the intellect can't absorb something which is confused and impure. It has to be broken down to its basic yesodis. It has to be broken down to its basic principles, to its basic foundations. And that's the art of learning Torah. Not to learn a list of the do's and don'ts. Not to learn 300 pages of Gemara. What's that going to help you? But to be able to take what you're learning and penetrate down and understand. That's the principle. That's what it is. Because a principle you can integrate. A principle you can apply. A principle can change you. A fact can't change you. You learn that you've got to put on tefillin. Can that change you? So you'll start putting on tefillin, but that also won't change you. You learn that you're not supposed to talk Lashon Hora, so you won't talk Lashon Hora. You'll carry on talking Lashon Hora. Just because you heard, you're not. We're nearly finished, but if anybody's got matches handy, then let's just... Nobody got? The human intellect and the human neshama can absorb principles and can apply principles, but anything more complicated than a basic and the intellect cannot relate to. So I must tell you that over the last couple of weeks I've been doing a lot of soul searching in terms of the role of our whole system of learning and the base of Medrash and the Shiurim and so on and so forth. And at this point already I want to make this clear. That in terms of digging the raw material out of the ground, that there's no way that I can undertake to provide the facilities, the mining facilities for anybody who's interested. Because it depends on the time that's available. It depends on the intellect that's available and the efficiency that's available. If you have time to learn, there's no way I can supply you with all the raw material you need. So you've got to go gathering raw material as much as you can handle, as much as you can purify. But one thing is important, the purification process. That's what I want to happen in the Beis HaMikdash. To teach you how to take the raw material which you've collected from wherever it may be, and take that and refine it down to the basic principles and learn how to live those principles and apply those principles. That's what we've got to do in the Beis HaMedrash. And that's what it is meant to mean, learning in the Beis HaMedrash. And that one has to do in one's Gemara, and in one's Dinim, and in one's Hashkofa, and in one's everything. Be able to penetrate to those principles the same as the body penetrates to the principles of the food it consumes, and be able to absorb it and digest it in the same way as the body does. And therefore, says Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm not going to draw a parallel between Torah and any of the other mitzvahs. I'm going to draw a parallel between Torah and any mitzvah of achila, of eating, because that's what we can compare it. There's one mitzvah of achila, and that's Korban Pesach. Is an idol worshipper allowed to eat Korban Pesach? No. But an idol worshipper is not allowed to get the Torah either. And therefore, his analysis is not only correct, but it penetrates to the essence of idolatry, of Torah, and of the Korban Pesach. And finally, just to answer the last question, which now becomes very simple. Why can a person who is uncircumcised, even if he was not obligated to become circumcised, why can he not eat from the Korban Pesach? Very simple. What's the purpose? What is the concept of circumcision? What is the concept of a bris milah? Don't think the Ribbono Shel Olam warns us that your only function in the world is to collect more. Your main function in the world is to decrease what you've got by taking the 1 ton and turning it into 3 grams, cutting away anything which is not necessary. Purify, purify, purify. until what you're left with is pure, is what you need and only what you need. And so symbolically the Rabbeinu Shalom creates us with a little bit more than we really need to function. And he says, you take it off. And that's one of the greatest mitzvahs, the mitzvah of a bris milah, which is the introduction of the young man's, the introduction of the young man into life. What's the first mitzvah which is done on him even before he knows it? Purification. Cut away the unessentials. Because anything that's not essential is a liability. That applies in gashmius, it applies in material possessions. Anything you don't need, get rid of. Because it's a nuisance. And when Mashiach comes and you have to go to Eretz Yisrael, it's going to cost you a lot to move it there, and it's going to cost you a lot to store it there, and there's not going to be place, and it's a big, big nuisance. Keep what you need and throw out the rest, or sell it, or do what you want. That's a principle that applies in everything. Purify. Get down to essentials. Those essentials should be nice. They should be attractive. They should be beautiful. They should be, in every way, something that one can live with happily. And each person's essentials varies. Some people need more and need less, but make sure that it's what you need, and that you don't have things that you don't need, and that you don't do things that you don't need. That's the essence of Tahara. To have what you need, to do what you need, to behave in a way which is needed, nothing more than that. Anything more than that is not neutral. It actually becomes negative. It holds you down. It becomes in the category of the kind of tumor about which we've been speaking. And so a man who's not had a bris, for whatever reason, is symbolically representative of a man who has something he doesn't need. His fault, not his fault, we're not going into that. The fact is he has something he doesn't need. The concept of the Korban Pesach is get rid of what you don't need. The two don't go together.